Welcome to The Social Network Show. How do you feel about social technology and this connected, networked world we live in? Your host of The Social Network Show, Dr. J, interviews informed and entertaining guests to tackle the most pressing digital issues of interest to business professionals and nonprofit leaders, to parents and educators, and to anyone wondering where all this is taking us. And now, your host, experimental psychologist, Dr. Jane Karwoski.
Innovation in technology speeds along ever faster and faster, and so do the wonders of consumer electronics. You may not upgrade to every new model as soon as it comes out, but all of your devices are slated for replacement eventually. What happens to them once you must move them over to accommodate the new kid on the block? Many are passed on to later adopters. You've probably passed on your old phone, tablet, etc. to family members, friends, who then have even older devices to put aside. But gradually, the heap of electronic waste worldwide accumulates higher and higher. Bear in mind that your mobile phone contains over 60 different metals, many of them toxic. In addition to what becomes of cast-off electronics, where do the brand new ones come from? Making one computer chip requires 630 times its weight in fossil fuel and chemicals. And you've heard of the perilous conditions that many electronics workers around the world face just doing their jobs. Today you will hear about one quick, simple thing you can do to promote responsible technology manufacturing and disposal. Your informant today is Ted Smith, a guy that's been calling the electronics industry to account from at least 1982 when he founded Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition. Yes, one thing you may not often associate with Silicon Valley is toxic waste, but following the grassroots effort to expose groundwater contamination with toxic solvents used in computer chip manufacturing in San Jose, California, 29 different sites in that county were identified by the EPA as Superfund cleanup sites, the highest concentration of such sites in the nation. Ted is also co-founder and chair of the steering committee of the Electronics Take Back Coalition, which is working to promote lifecycle producer responsibility within the high-tech electronics industry. In addition, Ted is co-founder and coordinator of the International Campaign for Responsible Technology, ICRT.co, an international network committed to working for the development of sustainable, non-polluting technologies. He is co-editor of Challenging the Chip, Labor Rights and Environmental Justice in the Global Electronics Industry. Most recently, he and co-author Chad Raphael contributed two chapters, Health and Safety Policies for Electronic Workers and The Future of Activism for Electronics Workers, to the just-published Routledge Companion to Labor and Media. Welcome back to the Social Network Show, Ted.
Hi, Jane. Thanks a lot for doing this show.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you for being our guest. You know, there's an image out there of clean tech in contrast to older industries. Does that mean that the electronics industry could be called green?
Well, I wish that were the case. And unfortunately, we learned a long time ago that the so-called clean industry was anything but green. They've put a huge amount of effort into promoting themselves as a responsible and clean industry. But the fact of the matter is that it's a chemical handling industry. They don't like people to kind of look behind the curtain. But what we've discovered over the years, as have many others, is that they use thousands of different chemicals to make all the various products. Many of these chemicals are known to be hazardous, can cause cancer, birth defects, neurotoxicity, etc. But also, many of those chemicals have never even been tested for their toxicity. So we're really all part of a big experiment. And unfortunately, there have been many, many examples of where this experiment has gone awry, and there have been really serious human health and environmental consequences.
And surprisingly, right here in the United States, where, you know, we kind of like to think we're protected by regulations and so forth, but in the Silicon Valley, before your organization, the Toxics Coalition, began to have some success. What was the situation? And also, could you tell us just what Silicon Valley encompasses? Where is it geographically?
There's still an ongoing debate of what is the capital of Silicon Valley. It's a mythical place. It's a little bit like Brigadoon. But it runs essentially from San Jose in the south up to Palo Alto, maybe even to San Mateo County, or increasingly even up to San Francisco. San Jose is at the base of San Francisco Bay. San Francisco is the top part on the west side. Oakland is over the top part on the east side, and then the East Bay also, which has towns like Fremont and Union City. They're all part of Silicon Valley now too. So it's as much a state of mind as anything, but it's really the area in the San Francisco Bay where the semiconductor industry first got started, and now is the headquarters for Apple and Google and Facebook and a lot of the other companies that have come to be household names.
So they're using the products that the original Silicon Valley firms were basically involved in producing. But what was the history? Can you just give us a rundown of the history there in Silicon Valley that you and your wife, Amanda Haas, you've been instrumental in that? How did this come about?
Well, Mandy and some of her colleagues actually were the real pioneers here in the late 70s. They started an organization called the Santa Clara Center for Occupational Safety and Health. And they focused on exploring and exposing the hazards in the workplace of the workers who were making the chips and how many of them were getting sick from exposure to those very nasty chemicals. And they started publishing some of that information and began to kind of puncture that clean industry mythology. But it was really in 1982 when it was learned that the chemicals had gotten out of the workplace and into our drinking water supply, that the rest of the valley really stood up and took note, because most people had believed the clean industry mythology. It was really quite a shock to the residents of this area to learn that not only was the electronics industry a chemical handling industry, but that significant numbers of people here in this area were getting sick from being exposed to the chemicals, whether it was in the workplace or whether it was through the drinking water. And there were families that came forward that had children with birth defects. The local media started picking up on it. The local politicians began to get rather embarrassed, because they're the ones who had been promoting the industry and had not been telling people what the real dark side of this industry was. So there was a tremendous outpouring, and it was from that that we were able to form the Toxics Coalition and then start getting a series of laws passed to try to protect people.
Well, that's really kind of a success story as far as activism is concerned, I think. It's really encouraging to see that changes were made, health conditions were improved, and so forth. However, I imagine that putting those jobs overseas, and it seems like that kind of coincided with increasing regulations in the United States, that a lot of these jobs and the plants were shipped overseas, so to speak. What about the human cost and the cost to nature in those, I assume, developing countries where the jobs are now? What is happening?
Yeah, we were able to start passing laws here in 1983. There were local laws, then it became California state law in 84, and then there was a national law passed in 1986, all of which focused on the right to know and better protection of people. And it was shortly after that that the industry started their exodus to move overseas. And they have since then really been, most of the new production has been taking place in Asia and to some extent Latin America. And unfortunately, the same kinds of patterns that we saw here have been emerging there, so that you now have, you know, quite a few examples of cancer clusters and birth defects in the manufacturing sites. You have tremendous examples of water pollution and air pollution So many of the rivers now in China are so polluted that they can no longer be used as drinking water sources. Same is true in Taiwan and many other places throughout Asia. There's huge cancer cluster now in Korea at Samsung, with their major chip manufacturing there. Likewise, there's been cancer clusters identified in Taiwan and elsewhere. So I think the same kinds of things that we began to document here several decades ago are now coming to the fore in many other places around the world.
Ted, you told me about a vision statement released in July 2015 by the Electronics Take Back Coalition that seems to start to answer a question that turns out to be surprisingly complex, and that is, what is a sustainable electronic product? And one of the first steps taken was to include the entire life cycle of electronics products. Could you outline for us what that life cycle is and what harms happen along the way?
Yeah, we've actually been working on trying to document the harms and to put forward a comprehensive life cycle vision, because we think that that's the best way to help people understand the real impact of the high-tech revolution. So when you think about where the stuff comes from that goes into making our cell phones and our televisions and our computers, etc., you got to start from where the actual raw materials come from. So there's a lot of mining. There's a lot of metals, as you mentioned. There's a lot of petrochemicals that go into making the plastics and things. So the extraction and mining part of it is the beginning part. Then you have all the fabrication of the components. You have huge factories that make chips, that make circuit boards, that make the hard drives, that make the screens for the TVs and the phones, etc. So you have to take into account all of that kinds of manufacturing impacts. Then you have the final assembly. You have transportation. Again, most of this stuff is made in various parts of the world. It is shipped usually by air between the various places it's being made, and then back to the consumer nations. And you know, by far, the vast majority of products are made in Asia, but consumed in the West. So the transportation costs are huge. Then you have the usage impacts. And of course, we all rely on the internet now, and we know that there are server farms that use enormous amounts of energy to power the internet. So you have all those impacts. And then at the end of the useful life, which is usually only a couple years, you have this enormous growing pile of what we call e-waste. And so then you have to look at the impacts of most of that from the U.S. still gets shipped overseas, where it's taken apart in very destructive ways. Eventually, if you do it right, you can recycle some of those materials back into new products. So people talk about the need to develop a circular economy where the same raw materials that you use can be used and then recycled back into new products. We're a long way from there, but that's a helpful part of the vision. So what we look at in this statement is, what are the hazards and the harm? What happens to the communities and the resources when these materials are being mined or extracted or constructed or fabricated? What are the natural resource implications in terms of energy and water? What are all the wasteful inputs, the virgin materials? What are the wasteful outputs? And then what about the sweatshop working conditions? We know from some of the media reports that some of these factories in China have hundreds of thousands of workers working very, very long on hours under very trying conditions, and leading to some very, very sad results. Just last week, there was yet another suicide in one of the big Chinese fabrication plants, which has been a rash, unfortunately, for quite a long time. And then we asked the final question of, you know, is there something about the current business model of electronics manufacturing, with the very short life cycle, with the rapid turnover, that makes all of these problems worse, and that we really need to examine if we want to talk about developing a sustainable electronics industry in the future?
You mentioned the server farms, and of course, that's something that's really involved in social networks. If obviously we all need a device to be on our social networks, but also the enormous amount of servers that are required, the cooling that's necessary, the backup generators that are necessary, the amount of electricity that is just gobbled up by that sort of thing. I had a guest on not too long ago, Andrew Blum, who wrote Tubes, A Journey to the Center of the Internet. And I think he did a wonderful job of explaining how the cloud is not an immaterial something or other. You know, it's very physical and it's very resource demanding. So there's lots of, go ahead.
Another example of how coming up with language can really be confusing. The cloud sounds like it's this wonderful, beautiful, serene, relaxing kind of a place. Well,
Anything but. Yeah. And we're going to continue in the second half of the show. Before we get into that, or a preview of that, you mentioned the mining and the toxic materials that result from mining. And gold is one thing that's required in electronics manufacturing. Yep. And we'll talk a bit about the recent release of sludge into the Animas River in Colorado and what impact that's going to have. So this is your host, Jane Karwoski, and you're listening to Ted Smith. He will share more thoughts with you about how we can help bring down the human and environmental cost of our favorite devices. And we'll look forward to that in the second half of today's episode.
Hi, I'm Mary from HashAdit.com, the social search engine. We don't just search for hashtags across multiple social media sites like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Pinterest. Our mission is to bring together like-minded individuals from around the world who share the same common passions and interests as you do. For those who do not know what a hashtag is, it's a pound sign attached to a word or an unspaced phrase. And today, they are everywhere, and I mean everywhere. Tweets, posts, photos, commercials, t-shirts, TV shows, music videos, song titles, album names in the bottom right-hand corners of TV screens, and at the final moments of movie trailers. Yes, sometimes it does feel like a hashtag overdose. Why are there so many hashtags? Well, it's a new and modern way to tag and gather information on a specific topic. HashAdit.com gathers that information and brings it to you. HashAdit.com is like a Google search engine, but for hashtags. My husband Tom uses it all the time to check out cool sports cars or get the latest breaking news. My daughter is obsessed with Miley Cyrus and Justin Bieber and visits hourly to get the latest photos or news on them both. My son is passionate about sports. Myself, I'm big on healthy foods and looking up my favorite furry animal, pugs. Again, it's an awesome place to see and follow what others who have the same interests as you are doing and talking about. And if you like, you can also sign up and create your own hashtag board with your very own unique URL, like world champion MMA fighter Tito Ortiz did. He shares it on his website so all his fans from around the world can get all the latest conversation posts about him. Tito Ortiz is a big name, so there will be people that will make inappropriate comments, and he knows his fans do not want to see that. HashAdit.com makes it so that we don't have to contribute to negativity and/or bullying. You can easily remove those posts on your hashtag board to make it pleasant, enjoyable, and G-rated. It's great for everyone. It's easy to use and share with your family, friends, and fans from around the world. Thanks for watching, and don't forget to search for the hashtag at HashAdit.com, the social search engine.
Questions? Comments? Reach out to us. Our email address is questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com or find us on Twitter at @SocialNetShow.
You're listening to The Social Network Show. I'm your host, Dr. J, and I'm talking with Ted Smith from the International Campaign for Responsible Technology. And I do encourage you to go to that website, icrt.co, because there's a wealth of information there. And you can read the vision statement from the Electronics Take Back campaign or coalition. I got to get the C's straight here. But for that, you can go to bit.ly/vision report, and that will take you through the whole nine yards of what Ted just briefly explained about the life cycle of electronics. And the challenge, we're going to talk more about this challenge, and that is the thing that you can do with very little time or effort. It is at bit.ly/challengehightech. All lowercase, all one word, challenge high tech at bit.ly. So to continue, Ted, we touched briefly on the fact that there has been a release of some toxic material, gallons and gallons of this. Can you tell us more about these abandoned gold mines or any other kind of mine that is, and just what happened in that instance?
Well, you know, we have a long history of mining in the U.S., as do people all around the world. And it's the minerals that they've extracted are oftentimes essential to an awful lot of the industrial processes, but in including jewelry, for instance, for gold. But gold's also used in electronics in very small amounts, as are many other minerals that are mined. Copper used to be lead, but a whole variety of minerals. But it's always been a very dirty process, and we now have something like over 50,000 abandoned mines in the U.S. And these mines, when water gets into them, starts a chemical reaction that can produce extremely toxic waste products. And at this example that you just mentioned, unfortunately, EPA was actually trying to clean up that mine, and they made a mistake and accidentally released a huge amount of this toxic sludge, which is now contaminating the rivers in Colorado. I've seen some of the pictures of it, and it's really disgusting. And this is unfortunately not a unique event. This is happening in many other places. So the ongoing impact of the life cycle of electronic products is a very serious issue that continues to haunt us, even from mining operations that ceased operation many years ago. So the legacy of all of this stuff is enormous, and it's going to continue to be here during the lifetimes of our children and our grandchildren, unfortunately.
That is bad enough. Of course, we want to. Part of the reason for putting a stop to this is so that it doesn't continue on for generation after generation with all of that just waiting to be released from the storehouses. So you're saying that basically it's rainfall runs into these abandoned mines and then creates even more toxic waste.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah,
the interaction of the water with the minerals creates just a real toxic brew. And so trying to figure out how do you neutralize that? How do you clean it up without even causing more harm? And in this case, unfortunately, it was the cleanup that actually caused the release of this toxic brew into the rivers.
Right, and it wasn't something, from what I read, it wasn't something that was deliberately blocked up, but simply a bunch of debris, sort of like a naturally occurring log jam or something that came loose. So I'm thinking about that kind of release and the toxicity of it. Is there a plan to stop that toxic waste from going into the Grand Canyon, for instance, or the Lake Powell and so forth? Are they trying to do a containment pond type of thing? Or
I'm sure they're scrambling to try to figure it out, but it's not an easy thing to do. And I'm not familiar enough with it to know the extent of what they've already done and what they're planning to do. But, you know, we have a local mine here in San Jose. It's an old mercury mine. It used to be the largest mercury mine in the world. They mine mercury in order to help extract the gold during the California Gold Rush. And that old mine is still putting out mercury residue that has been contaminating the Guadalupe River that runs through the center of San Jose. They've been able to get that reasonably well under control now. But again, this goes back over 100 years, and the legacy is still very much here in the present. So these are enormous challenges. And the problem is that we're still trying to clean up problems that happened, you know, years or decades ago. And yet the new industry is creating new problems that are going to be with us for a long time. So the challenges are huge. And that's why we really need to be focusing on what can we be doing now to try to prevent these kinds of ongoing problems in the future.
Well, issuing this challenge to the electronics industry is, you spell out some specifics that you want them to do to make, for one thing, investigate and use safer chemicals. But is that, you know, we automatically assume that if there's going to be more regulations or more careful use of the process, that this is going to raise prices. How much would it actually raise the price of our products that we want if the companies were to start creating a sustainable industry?
I haven't seen any thorough analysis of what it would actually take. I mean, if you really used safer chemicals, if you really did protect the workers and didn't overwork them, if you didn't expose them to the chemicals, if you took good care of the materials throughout the whole life cycle, what the additional cost of that would be. But it's small compared to the overall cost of the product. Right now, we know a new iPhone costs anywhere from $600 to $650 unless you get it with one of your service providers. But we also know that the cost of the wages portion of that $600 is only around $4 or $5. So it's a very, very tiny fraction of the overall cost. So even if you doubled the amount of money going to support the workers and to protect the workers, it still would only add a few more dollars. And out of $600, if you added another $5 or $10, you know, most people are not going to even notice that. So I think that that's the range of what I've heard it would take. And I think that, you know, most consumers, if they were confronted with the reality of if you wanted to pay another $5 or $10 for your phone, would you, if you knew that it was going to protect the workers and the environment better than what we're doing, I think most people would say, sure, that's fine.
Oh, yes, I agree. It would, even if it were a larger percentage, yeah. You know, when I think when people
say it would cost more. And the truth is, we don't really know. But there's no question that right now, I don't think it's an economic concern. I think, you know, the industry changes so fast that I think it's basically hopeless to expect government's going to come in and pass laws or regulations to make things right. I think it has to be consumers who are activated, both individual consumers as well as institutional purchasers and government purchasers and university purchasers, who are going to really help turn things around when they say, okay, we will not buy your products unless you meet the following kinds of challenges. And that's what we really were trying to do when we put together this challenge to the electronics industry. This is something that purchasers can use to put demands on the industry. And we think that once the industry starts feeling those demands, they're gonna do it. This is an enormously innovative, creative industry. We all know that. And if they and they say that they will, they listen to their customers. So if they start hearing from customers that we want sustainable products, and here's what we mean by that, I think that they're going to be able to respond. And some companies already are starting.
So who is doing a good job right now? Is there someone that, you know, companies that seem to be responding in a better fashion than the average?
Well, at the end of the process, when we got people together from all around the world this past January and came up with our challenge, we invited in a series of representatives from some of the companies that are starting to pay attention and to make a difference on this. And so we had people from Hewlett-Packard and Apple and Seagate and Flextronics come in, as well as a handful of others. We had their association called the Electronics Industry Citizenship Coalition come in, and we were able to present to them what it was that we came up with. And we've got the 6 points in our action plan, which is, you know, we want you to be transparent about everything. We want you to use safer chemicals. We want you to do a lot better job at protecting your workers. You need to participate, have participation from workers and communities. So there needs to be a lot of education and training to help oversee all this. You have to protect the communities and the environment, and then you have to compensate and remediate for the harm that's already been caused. So that's kind of the 6-point plan, and we presented that, and they had actually invited us to come present this at 3 of their forums around the world, in Europe and Mexico and here in the U.S. And we now have an ongoing dialogue going on with a handful of the companies that really are trying to take some leadership on this. So I think that there is some movement. There's also an organization in Europe called Fairphone, which is already manufacturing phones for people in Europe. It's not available here in the U.S., but they are making phones and are, you know, doing a lot better job than most of the brands in terms of really addressing where the materials come from. They're not using any conflict minerals, and they're paying attention to the working conditions of the workers, and they have a vision of their own product, which is fairly similar to our own. So I think that there are some initiatives that are emerging that I'm feeling somewhat optimistic about. And I think that the more that the industry hears from their consumers, again, the individual consumers and the institutional consumers, the more that this message is going to start getting through and they're going to start to respond.
Mm-hmm. On the website icrt.co, there is on the right half of the landing page some news items. If you click on the ones about the challenge, there's one with an infographic which contains a video of a Chinese worker, and it's very touching and just reveals just what the situation is. I think so many times people say, oh, they don't want to buy from China. Oh, made in China. Oh, they're taking all our jobs. Well, this kind of job, who would want it? Because it's just so irresponsible and exploitative of the workers. So it's fascinating to look over that as well as the vision report, because that goes into depth and gives you a host of other resources. I just think it's a wonderful portal for learning more about this. The idea of Fairphone sounds great. Some innovative things like that, and I agree with you on the industry itself can seems to be able to solve almost any problem, and if we insist that this is a problem. So the first thing we can do is endorse that challenge. Again, bit.ly/challengehightech, and that will take you right to the challenge and the blanks, the spots you can fill in with your endorsement of it.
What we are trying to do is to get a lot more video up on the web, because I do think that that's a really important way to let people really understand and experience what it's like working in some of these factories. The one that you mentioned is from a new film that's coming out this year called Who Pays the Price. It's very, very effective. It has lots of interviews with young workers and people who live in the communities around some of these factories. There's another movie coming out called Death by Design, which is also going to be focusing on some of the history here in Silicon Valley that we've been talking about, but also then branching out to follow the growth of the industry around the world. There have been two movies that have come out in Korea that have documented the Samsung cancer cluster there. So I think we're beginning to see more and more of this kind of visual presentation of what's happening. And I think the more that people see this, the more that people are going to want to help solve these problems.
Right. The awareness of it is, of course, very important. And that is, it's been fascinating to learn this amount of information and to know that, like you said, consumers have power. And well, there is, on one of those sites, one of the organizations has created a ranking of companies, correct?
Yeah, actually Greenpeace has been doing that for the last few years. And the challenge is that they don't, on their current website, take into account the whole life cycle. It's a very challenging and difficult thing to do. What they've done is to pick a handful of some of the nastiest materials that are being used and to rank companies on who's doing the best job in getting rid of those nasty chemicals and replacing them with safer ones. So, and there's a few other groups out there that do these kinds of rankings. I think what we really need is a comprehensive method of ranking that takes into account this whole life cycle. We're not there yet, but I think that's the direction that we're going.
Well, I think that the vision report is certainly a big step forward, because you look at that and you've got all kinds of charts that indicate, like matrices that indicate on which aspect of life cycle what needs to be done and so on. You mentioned conflict metals, and that is puts me in the mind of the movie Blood Diamond, I think did a lot to raise awareness of that. But this is also a big factor in metals that are used for the electronics industry, correct?
Yeah, there's terrible things going on in parts of Africa particularly, where they call it the three T's in gold. It's tantalum, tungsten, and tin are metals that are mined there. And oftentimes the mines are in the middle of areas that are engaged in civil wars. And so the profits from the mining is being used to buy weapons to fuel the civil war. And oftentimes they draft young kids either to help with the mining or to fight in their wars. And so there's actually been a global outcry against supporting this kind of behavior to get materials for cell phones. So you're right, it's like blood diamonds. This time it's the blood metals. And mm-hmm. There was actually a law passed in the U.S. a couple of years ago as part of the Dodd-Frank law that requires that companies start reporting on where their minerals come from. So again, it's this transparency issue, and that is helping to drive things. But there's many, I mean, there's mining going on in Indonesia right now with very similar kinds of human impacts, just terrible consequences going on. And again, if people just want to Google a little bit of that to see some of the video, you can do conflict minerals in Africa, you can do mining disasters in Indonesia, and you'll come up with some of the video that shows what's actually happening. And I think, again, once people see that, those images don't go away, they stay with you, and then that can help people make some of their decisions.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Ted. I really appreciate it.
Well, again, I appreciate the fact that you're doing this, Jane. It's important to get this out, and I hope we get a lot more people paying attention and joining in to help move this whole struggle forward.
Right. And again, to endorse that challenge personally or through your business, you can go to bit.ly/challengehightech. And thank you all for listening. Ted Smith of ICRT.co has been here to alert you to the tremendous toll our latest devices is taking on people and nature around the world, and giving us something we can do about it. We bring you leaders in business, cyber citizenship, and the ethical, legal, and social implications of our networked, connected world. Please shop for our app in Google Play or the iTunes App Store, the Social Network Show, and share it with your friends. Our listener survey is podsurvey.com/social. So do have fun and be safe online and off until we meet you here again.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the worldwide show dedicated to social media networking and understanding the connected, networked world we live in. Listen to our archive shows on thesocialnetworkshow.com and follow us on Twitter @SocialNetShow. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, Incorporated. The views and opinions expressed are those of our host and guest and may not be the views and opinions of Social Network Intermedia.